By the late 1870s, he still desperately sought knowledge of his patrimony, his birthday, the meaning of his roots in what was once a place of pain and among relationships he would recall with extremist abhorrence. He was a genius at fashioning his story of ascendance, but also forever in search of a lost past that might allow him a stable psychic peace. For complex reasons, he also needed to exercise some forgiveness. Public vengeance and distrust for the slaveholding South lived in Douglas alongside a solicitude for the people who had owned him. Only in immersing himself in that contradiction could he truly gain self-knowledge. In Baltimore, at Fells Point, Douglas boarded the steamer Matilda for an overnight trip down the Chesapeake Bay, the water highway that had carried so many of his dreams. On board the 200-foot stern wheeler were approximately 100 blacks, like Douglas on a brief holiday. The ship had no real accommodations, and Douglas reportedly found the behavior of his fellow passengers appalling. With banjos strumming, dancing ensued. Liquor bottles were passed. Revelers made loud noise all night and relieved themselves over the deck railings. With his sense of racial pride and class dignity insulted, the Baltimore Sun recorded Douglas complaining that 100 colored people aboard made as much noise as 500 whites would have done. In his speech, made at a picnic round in St. Michael's a day later, he preached to the blacks assembled, "We must not talk about equality until we can do what white people can do. As long as they can build vessels and we cannot, we are their inferiors. As long as they can found governments and we cannot, we are their inferiors." This harsh language flowed from Douglas when he felt embarrassed by some of his people. At this stage of life, his class status seemed easily offended. Such were the contradictions of his chosen path of leadership. The paragon of respectability found some of the fun-loving habits of the recently emancipated unsavory. Douglas much preferred violins to banjos. When Douglas arrived in St. Michael's, he found a town where most blacks still lived in shacks, and their economic conditions had not changed much since the end of slavery. A crowd of blacks and whites followed him as he strolled through streets. Many came up to shake his hand, and although his sister Eliza was not among them, a group of younger Mitchells, her extended family, and other kinfolk joined the impromptu parade. In this sleepy, oyster-harvesting and boat-building town, Douglas must have appeared like some tall, leonine, white-haired African ruler returning in Western clothing. He later called this homecoming strange enough in itself, but that he was about to meet his former master was still more strange. A messenger brought word that Auld had agreed to see him at the home of the old man's daughter and son-in-law, Louisa and William H. Bruff. The gawking entourage followed him to the corner of Cherry Street and Locust Lane, where, as Dixon Preston, our best chronicler of Douglas's returns to the Eastern Shore, wrote, "It was the first time that a black man had ever entered a white home in St. Michael's by the front door, as an honored guest." Auld was sick, bedridden, his hands palsied, as Douglas described him. The two men met for about 20 minutes in an emotional, humane encounter of past and present. Douglas thought he was witnessing Auld on his deathbed, although the former slave owner would not die for 2.5 more years. As autobiographer, Douglas recreated this drama with a customary vividness and irony. He entitled the chapter, "Time Makes All Things Even." He did not say time cures all ills, nor had he begged for Auld's forgiveness, as the Baltimore Sun's reporter claimed. But he may have revealed a deep yearning to heal his own soul, to find a purging of his scarred memory, to forgive in a way that helped him to finally declare publicly his survival and triumph. In much of Christian tradition, in which Douglas had learned to think and write, the forgiver often forgives for his own sake, not to excuse the oppressor. He forgives to strengthen his own heart, to work through grief, pain, loss, and hatred. Douglas had striven long and far and come to see that some self-understanding may rest at the end of the precept, "Forgive, and ye shall be forgiven." Former slave met former owner, but Douglas needed this meeting most. In part, Douglas used the reunion to try to demonstrate a changed country as measured in his own life. "Auld had made property to my body and soul," wrote the memoirist, "reduced me to a chattel, hired me out to a noted slave breaker to be worked like a beast and flogged into submission." In turn, Douglas had traveled the world, making his old master's name and his deeds familiar in four different languages as the symbol of all that was evil in American slavery. For so many years, Douglas had wreaked a prophetic vengeance on slavery, slaveholders, the Confederacy, their memory, and all they stood for. Now, in a bedroom of an old brick house in St. Michael's, Maryland, nearby where Auld had whipped Fred Bailey and rented him down the road to Edward Covey, it was as if the aging Douglas glimpsed his own mortality and his own frail humanity way down beneath all the brilliant anti-slavery rhetoric. Douglas irresistibly went to the sick man's bedside and suddenly found himself holding his, Auld's, hand and in friendly conversation with him in a sort of final settlement of past differences, preparatory to his stepping into his grave, where all distinctions are at an end, and where the great and the small, the slave and his master, are reduced to the same level. So Douglas went to St. Michael's to declare his equality, and in a way to practice a self-renewing forgiveness. He was the one dispensing the equality. With words, he was trying to bury slavery once and for all in the very soil of his birth. The entire nation's sins were still in desperate need of remission. He was to me no longer a slaveholder, either in fact or in spirit, wrote the famous black man of the obscure white man, and I regarded him as I did myself, a victim of the circumstances of birth, education, law, and custom. Their mutual fates had been determined for us, not by us. Douglas the Avenger changed his tune as both men shed tears, one of them with hand trembling, and ready to step into the eternal unknown. Douglas, the former war propagandist, recalled, "Even the constancy of hate breaks down before the brightness of infinite light." He had long needed breaks from hating. The two men talked about the past. Auld called the younger man Marshall Douglas, and the former slave called the older man Captain Auld. But Douglas interrupted and insisted, "Not Marshall, but Frederick to you, as formerly." The scene later caused a swirl of protest among younger blacks, since it was reported in papers as, "Just call me Fred." This made the former slave look as though he had kowtowed to the former slaveholder. A cartoon even appeared showing Douglas kneeling as he approached Auld. Douglas was keenly interested in what Auld thought of his running away, to which the old denizen of Methodist camp meetings answered, "Frederick, I always knew you were too smart to be a slave." Douglas assured Auld that he had not run away from you, but from slavery. "It was not that I loved Caesar less, but Rome more." Douglas apologized for his former charge that Auld had put his grandmother, Betsy, out to die. That had been, Douglas admitted, a mistake in my narrative. Finally, the former Fred Bailey of mysterious patrimony even asked Auld if he could determine his, Douglas's, birth year, to which the old master replied, 1818, making his guest a year younger than he had realized. That destitution of never knowing his birthday was now at least partially assuaged. Just why and how Auld knew the year so readily remains part of the mystery. Douglas took such care with this account in Life and Times, he maintained, because his ever-ready critics, the heartless triflers, had made mischief out of his return to St. Michael's. He tried to set the record straight, but he also needed to know if the shabby surroundings of the Eastern Shore could quiet the noise in his soul, help him to discover just who he was now that he had transcended Covey's farm for Washington's City Hall. Douglas visited the palsied Auld to see whether a qualified forgiveness for one slave owner could still his rage against all of them. The search for self-knowledge, however, did not in the least diminish his embrace of self-help doctrines. In his outdoor speech that afternoon, he declared himself a lover of Maryland, a proud Eastern shoreman, and above all, He urged the poor black folk to get money and keep it, and thereby demand self-respect. As the visit to the Eastern Shore demonstrated, the famous Douglas now lived a life of constant conflict between public and private imperatives. He needed the Beatitudes for his own quiet reasons. A year and a half later, in the late fall of 1878, Douglas returned a second time to the Eastern Shore. Invited by the local Republican Party for a paid lecture, he went to speak at the Talbot County Courthouse, where he had been jailed for plotting to escape in 1836, as well as at the Bethel and Asbury AME churches. This time he journeyed aboard an overnight steamer, Highland Light, on which he broke a color line by staying in a stateroom. The visit to Easton became a kind of celebrity's welcome. Breaking yet another color barrier, Douglas stayed at the Brick Hotel, the town's finest, and took meals at Lowe's Tavern, just across the street from where he and the Harris brothers had been jailed in chains, and where 45 years earlier he had witnessed tobacco-chewing, gazing slave traders, groping and sizing up their prey. The former slave relished all these ironies. The old prison metaphors of the narrative gave way in Life and Times to new rushes of memory. There stood the old jail, with its whitewashed walls and iron gratings, as when in my youth I heard its heavy locks and bolts clank behind me. The nearly 80-year-old Joseph Graham, former sheriff of Talbot County, and the man who had locked Douglas in that jail so long ago, attended the lecture in the courthouse, welcoming the former inmate and shaking his hand. All eyes in Easton were on the tall, 60-year-old man with a large crop of gray hair, as he strolled the streets that had been so forbidden in his youth. An Easton Gazette reporter seemed to follow Douglas everywhere, describing a large man of full habit, but not obese. His color, that of a bright mulatto. His features, not at all those of a Negro, except that there is a slight depression of the nose and spreading of the nostrils. The two black congregations of Bethel and Asbury gathered to hear the returning hero on the Sunday afternoon, November 24th. On Monday, to a racially mixed audience crowded into the courthouse, Douglas gave a modified version of Self-Made Man. His speech, according to the one account, came with two stern messages: prescriptions for self-help and hard work for blacks, and for whites, his old plea to give the freedmen fair play, and then let him alone. To the whites he further demanded that they not form your Ku Klux Klan and your rifle clubs to drive him, the Negro, from the polls. The Gazette reporter thought the lecture had thrilled every bosom. Perhaps the most poignant moment in that evening's speech came when Douglas described his daytime journey in a hired rig out to Tapper's Corner and the walk through fields of the farm once owned by Aaron Anthony to the horseshoe bend in the Tuckahoe River, searching for the exact location of his birth. Louis Freeman, a local former slave who had once lived on that same farm, accompanied Douglas. The two of them studied the landscape and found a long gully leading up from the river. Here was what Douglas had once remembered as the ravine. Grandma Betsy's cabin was long gone, as was the old well. Douglas trudged into the briars and brush looking for an old cedar tree. There it was, grown much larger than in his boyhood. He believed he had found the spot. Douglas knelt in solitude and reverence, and with bare hands scooped up handfuls of soil to take back with him to his Washington home. That night, in the lecture, he told the assembled that he had obtained some of the very soil on which I first trod. With some of Talbot County's dirt, Douglas now had a sacred talisman to observe or touch or perhaps even smell, when he needed to reflect on the meaning of his double life on both sides of the Chesapeake. Through his senses, it might have given him a way to pay homage to his mother and grandmother, to the blood and toil they had left in that soil. In the narrative, Douglas told us he had no recollection of seeing his mother by the light of day. In Bondage and Freedom, his more lengthy attempt to remember his mother could end only with, "Her grave is as the grave of the dead at sea, unmarked, and without stone or stake." Bowing down on the ground where his life began, his hands shoving aside the late November leaves and pushing down into the cold soil, may have been for Douglas a profoundly private way of recognizing how unsettling, unfinished, and even unattainable the story of his life truly remained. That soil provided, though, one kind of fact he had come to the eastern shore to find. Harriet Bailey was there somewhere, and so was he. Before leaving the eastern shore, Douglas paid a visit to Charleston to the south in Dorchester County, the area where Harriet Tubman had hailed from. He reconnected once again with his brother Perry, now old and infirm. Douglas took Perry back to Washington with him, and until Perry died less than 2 years later, he lived with the Douglases among the growing household clan. Pointing to this touching fact, an Easton Gazette reporter struggled to capture the remarkable contrasts of Douglas's visit. Calling the story wonderful, the Gazette fashioned a memory of it to fit both reality and mythology. He left our county under compulsion. He comes back by invitation, not to ask pardon of those whom he had disobeyed, but to extend pardon to those by whom he had been wronged. He left as a fugitive. He comes back, our equal before law. As if white Marylanders could now claim Douglas in the present by erasing his past, the paper concluded, "He left us a nigger. He returns a gentleman." With a bag full of soil and his older brother, the marshal hurried back to the District of Columbia. By the end of the 1870s, Douglas thrived, at least symbolically, at the center of American political life. He continued in the mundane tasks of the marshal's office, but what he dealt with daily were the vicissitudes of fame, constant criticism, and controversy. Douglas is a distinctive example of the nature of fame in 19th century America. His was a fame of achievement, the celebrated American self-made variety. This fame was enmeshed with the country's most compelling story of slavery, its destruction, and new visions of freedom, about which he was a prominent author. But his was also, as the historian Leo Brody writes, a visible modern fame that emerged in the age of the rapid growth of newspapers and magazines, the development of the railroad and the telegraph, along with the rapid sophistication of photography. Douglas was a lover and student of photography, which he cultivated as a means of spreading his influence through his image. Over more than 50 years, 1841 to 1894, Douglas sat for approximately 160 photographs and wrote some 4 essays or addresses that were in part about the craft and meaning of pictures. In engravings and lithographs, his image graced the pages or cover of all major illustrated papers in England and the United States. His picture was captured in all major forms of photography, from the daguerreotype to stereographs and wet plate albumen prints. Photographers, some famous and some not, all across the country sought out Douglas for his image. As the historians of his image have shown, the orator performed for the camera. He especially presented himself without props, his own stunning person representing African-American masculinity and citizenship. He helped to choose the frontispieces for his autobiographies, which carried his photograph, and he especially sought to create for a wide audience successive images of the intelligent, dignified black man and statesmanlike elite. At the same time, he understood that photography had evolved into a democratic art, allowing almost anyone to leave an image for posterity. Visually, by the 1870s and 1880s, Douglas was one of the most recognizable Americans. The dissemination of photographs of him became, therefore, a richly political act. Loved and hated, along with the living Grant and the mythic Lincoln, he was the American story, and he put a face on it. Douglas instinctively loved politics and debate, and never lacked for opinions. He continued to preach unapologetically to blacks about self-reliance. In February 1878, at an unveiling of a print of Francis Bicknell Carpenter's famous painting, First Reading of the Emancipation Proclamation at Howard University, where Douglas served as a trustee, and in the presence of President Hayes and other dignitaries, Douglas stressed the necessity of blacks learning to build ships and domes as the path to social respect. These kinds of remarks brought steady chastisement from some quarters. By early 1879, An Elmira, New York paper accused Douglas of believing nothing can be done in the face of the collapse of Hayes's policy of conciliation and the South's increased violence and discrimination against blacks. The editorialist claimed Douglas had settled down in his old age in a comfortable federal office, counseling his people to suffer and wait. This is not the tone of his olden speech. It is sad to see such a transformation. Douglas had become pathetic, said his former allies, a mere small voice for peace. They got the old radicals' attention. Douglas wrote an angry letter to the Elmira Advertiser. "I never said nothing can be done," he roared, calling for moral indignation and investigations of Southern conditions. They had wounded him. "When the influence of office or any other influence shall soften my hatred of tyranny and violence, do not spare me. Let fall upon me the lash of your keenest and most withering censure." He received plenty of censure, even from old comrades such as Samuel Porter in Rochester, who cautioned him about losing his moral bearings as a political insider. Douglas responded with this metaphoric assurance of his integrity. "Thanks for your gentle warning. The perils are abundant in every part of the voyage of life, and are as abundant when nearing the shore as when in mid-ocean. I can only promise to keep a man at the masthead, and a sharp lookout, and a firm hand on the helm." Despite all these challenges, Douglas continued to carry the self-made man lecture all over the American map. A typical example is a trip he made out to Staunton, Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley, in April 1879. As so often happened with these events, a brass band and large delegation met Douglas at the depot and escorted him first to a hotel, where local worthies called upon him, and then to Augusta Street Methodist Church. "The sanctuary was filled to the rafters," reported the Valley Virginian, "to see the bright mulatto orator. The middle pews were reserved for some 200 white people, with a city council sitting up front. Blacks sat around the sides and in a balcony. A black jubilee choir sang, and then Douglas held forth for 2.5 hours, performing, according to the local reporter, routines and arguments intended to entertain and please the whites. He allowed the white town fathers to feel proud of their Christian paternalism, as long as they exercised it with benevolence. Anticipating in style and substance some of what Booker T. Washington would later make legendary, Douglas prescribed self-reliance for the balcony and peace and economic cooperation for the middle pews. "These Negroes are among you and will remain with you," declared Douglas to the Virginians. Then came the Indian analogy, devoid of any attention to the murder and mass displacement of native peoples underway at that very moment. "You need not expect them to die out like the Indians. They are too fond of civilizing influences. An Indian is contented with a blanket, while a Negro's ambition is a swallow-tailed coat. The Indians don't like churches and steeples, while the Negro thinks the higher the steeple, the nearer they are to heaven." Douglas urged the Staunton whites to embrace their sturdy black neighbors in economic and political harmony. "They, blacks, are essentially imitative, and if by their efforts they seek to raise themselves from poverty and attain to the excellence of good citizenship, give them a chance. Don't place unnecessary obstacles in their way. Let them alone, and if they die out, let them die. Sell them lands, and let them practice your economy and thrift." Such rhetoric may have worked in making the middle pews in a Southern church feel a social peace on a spring afternoon. But out in the larger society, at that very moment, a different, desperate movement had taken hold. In the spring and through the summer of 1879, Kansas fever, an exodus impulse, spread over the desperately poor tenant farming blacks of the states of Tennessee, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. The urge to migrate to better conditions, with a dream of land ownership and economic independence, had risen and fallen in parts of the South ever since emancipation. But by the spring of 1879, a perfect storm of causes and inducements coalesced to prompt approximately 6,000 freed people and their children to head for the banks of the Mississippi River in search of steamboats. They were driven by a combination of tenant farming debt and economic despair since the Depression of 1873. Most worked on shares of their cotton in a cash-poor economy, faced extortion practiced by landowners and furnishing merchants, and a resurgence of bulldozing, the night-riding violence against black communities. They further set hopeful eyes on Kansas because of some political promises of federal financial assistance made by their remaining Republican allies in the U.S. Congress. And for many desperate people, a millenarian religious impulse pushed them to the horizons seeking a new dispensation from God on their Kansas exodus to a promised land, not of milk and honey, but of property ownership and flourishing schools in their own black-run towns, a long way from Pharaoh's night riders. The Kansas Exodus received enormous press attention around the country and was fiercely debated among black leaders and their allies, even as some white Southerners lowered rents on their tenants, frightened that they might lose their laborers. Should agricultural black Southerners leave the homes and lands they had always known and worked? Fed up with the betrayal, political exclusion, and terror, many black leaders urged on the Exodus, raised money, and demanded the government help finance and protect the migration. President Hayes's policy of conciliation toward the South in return for promises of reform, peace, and protection of black rights from Southern Democrats had failed disastrously. Indeed, Democrats took control of both houses of Congress in the elections of 1878, and the Republican Party was a dying institution in the former Confederacy. Hayes put faith in the long-term effects of education and urged blacks to learn industry, self-reliance, self-control, economy, and thrift. To a black educator in Florida considering migration to the Midwest in July 1879, Hayes urged, "Stay where you are. You are natives of the South, and you are entitled to remain there. I know you are assaulted and bulldozed, but stick. Time and the North will set you right." In such pathetic terms, Hayes had given up on any real federal protection for the freedmen. On the Exodus, with different reasoning, Douglas essentially agreed with the president. The Exodus inspired an extremely divisive debate. "I never found myself more painfully at variance with leading colored men of the country," Douglas wrote just 2 years later, "than when I opposed the effort to set in motion a wholesale exodus of colored people." In 1878, he reiterated that he had always abstractly seen such schemes of emigration as a delusion and a scam. "The white race is everywhere on the face of the globe, and we could not get away from them if we would." Especially agonizing for Douglas were claims made by fellow blacks that he had deserted to the old master class and become a traitor to my race. At a mass meeting about the Exodus in New York in late April 1879, attended by an array of black and white former abolitionists, Douglas was loudly hissed when he was announced to speak in opposition to the Kansas movement. He responded in speeches and with letters to his critics in the press. He angrily wrote to the People's Advocate of Washington after that paper accused him of turning a deaf ear to the sufferings of the Exodusters. "You could hardly make a more grievous charge against me, and let me therefore ask you for the evidence upon which it is based. The reputation of colored public men, built up by long years of public service, should not be wantonly thrown away." But this debate functioned less on evidence than on racial solidarity and despair at Reconstruction's failure. Blacks everywhere fiercely disputed whether the South had become an irredeemable Egypt or a promised land still worth fighting for. Douglas was especially wounded by critics who called him a fawning sycophant who abandoned his people. A target now for many disappointments among black leadership in the Gilded Age, Douglas tried to fight back. With few exceptions, such as Blanche K. Bruce and PBS Pinchback, black Southern politicians who opposed mass immigration from Louisiana or Mississippi, Douglas stood virtually alone as the major opponent of the Exodus. His celebrity brought perhaps inordinate attention to his opinions. Black Southern politicians favored the Exodus in varying ways. So did the legendary Sojourner Truth, who went to Kansas herself and lent moral support to the migrants. Northern black leaders, who had long been either friends or rivals of Douglas's, such as George T. Downing, Richard T. Greener, and John Mercer Langston, all became vocal advocates of the Exodus. Douglas held open public debates with Langston and Greener. Douglas further came under censure in state-level black conventions, such as one in Nashville, Tennessee, in May 1879, where the Kentucky-born Ohio state legislator, Robert J. Harlan, a half-brother of Supreme Court Justice John M. Harlan, argued in a widely reprinted speech that the South had collapsed into another Egypt, and that emigration westward was the freed people's only remedy. Douglas fired some angry salvos in a speech in Baltimore in May 1879, where he vigorously rejected the equivalencies drawn by some Exodus advocates between pre-war chattel slavery and the current plight of the freed people. He renewed his long-practiced loathing of schemes of colonization and emigration, which he believed had historically hurt black people. Moreover, in a piece in the National View, Douglas laid out 10 reasons why he was opposed to this exodus. His arguments boiled down to the idea that blacks, however poor or scorned, should never give up on the revolution of emancipation, not offer an untimely concession to white racism, and never surrender on the achievement of equality. By November, Douglas was still devoting enormous time to point-by-point attempts in newspapers to refute Langston or others. Douglas wrote a lengthy paper on the exodus in September 1879, at the invitation of the American Social Science Association. He was to appear in a point-counterpoint debate with Richard T. Greener, Harvard's first black graduate, dean of the Howard University Law School, and a cantankerous intellectual nemesis of Douglas's. At the last minute, Douglas did not travel to Saratoga Springs, New York, in September to the association's annual meeting. The address was read for him by Francis Wayland III, professor and dean of the Yale Law School. In this carefully crafted essay, later published with Greener's rejoinder, Douglas first demonstrated a sympathetic understanding of the economic plight of black Southerners and why they would feel entitled to their right to emigrate. He delivered a robust, if somewhat naive, analysis of the South's dependence on black labor. Black brawn and skill had always been the admitted author of whatever prosperity, beauty, and civilization possessed by the South, the arbiter of her destiny. The freedmen, Douglas argued, in defiance of much evidence, had a monopoly on the labor market, and with no competitors, he can demand living prices with the certainty that the demand will be complied with. How dearly so many desperate sharecroppers wished they had some control over such a bargain. Naively, Douglas sustained his faith in the triumph of free labor and universal manhood suffrage. It was as though the busy martial orator had thrown up a psychological wall of denial in his mind about the reality of racial oppression in the South. He believed all successful people and cultures must have a native land. A wandering people, in his view, only garnered collective disrespect. But at its heart, the Saratoga address was a plea against what the Washington Insider deemed a surrender, a premature, disheartening surrender of the great causes of the Civil War era: abolitionism, emancipation, the Reconstruction Amendments, equal rights, independence, and self-reliance, and the U.S. government's responsibility of protection and enforcement. In Douglas's logic, the exodus was an abandonment of all worthy principles. It was victory turned into a miserable compromise, or worse, into slow defeat of the Second American Republic. Leaving the South meant that in the long run, the Confederacy had won. Douglas demanded that blacks stay and fight, with their labor and especially their votes. The possibility of power, he argued, existed only where blacks could sustain large populations, breed their own officeholders, and prevail at the ballot box. It was as if Douglas counseled a million desperate tenant farmers who had watched some of their kinfolk brutalized or murdered, trying to vote, to bide their time, and stay and fight for the dream of political liberalism. Douglas had always hated the arguments at the base of colonization schemes. The exodus was to him, therefore, an apostleship of despair that the old orator in the Oberlin tent in 1848 from Corinthian Hall stage in 1852, or on the altar of Tremont Temple in 1863, and a thousand other venues, just could not abide. But a tide of history had swept over his cherished principles and left them in tatters. No matter the depth of their misery, humiliation, or hopelessness, Douglas urged black Southerners to stay put and keep fighting. In effect, he asked poor farmers who despaired of their future to take a long view and to carry the weight of his version of the nation's memory and history. At stake was the very integrity of his own story and that of Union victory. The animating center of a series of 12 resolutions against the exodus that he prepared for a public gathering in Hillsdale, District of Columbia, in the summer of 1879, was his claim that mass migration now meant the late rebellion will have triumphed, the rebel South will have been exalted. So Douglas stood his ground, flailed away at bitter reality, and insisted that history, against the odds, stay on course. Those poor farmers caught up in migration fever, however, were not playing for history. They needed safety, their own land, an escape from the furnishing merchant, and hope. Douglas was not merely blind and out of touch, as some biographers have contended. He found himself in a position, a decade and a half after emancipation, not unlike many leaders of the modern civil rights movement. They have to fight to protect political and constitutional triumphs, as well as a new national historical memory, while they also face a deepening crisis of structural repression and inequality. Douglas's story, when he was heroically right as well as disappointingly wrong, was a rehearsal for the long haul of post-emancipation and post-civil rights black and progressive leadership, who have encountered foes as virulent as the Democratic Party's Southern Redeemers of the 1870s and much of the Republican Party in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. With a $6,000 loan in 1878 from a black friend and former abolitionist, Robert Purvis, Douglas purchased Cedar Hill, a house on a 15-acre estate on the Heights in Anacostia, in the southeast part of the District of Columbia. He and Anna, and parts of the extended family, moved permanently to the estate in 1878. Some 40 yards or so behind the big house, beyond the lawn where friends and family played croquet, Douglas constructed his growlery, a small single-room stone structure complete with a writing desk and a chaise lounge. At times, the desk may have been that of Charles Sumner, a keepsake the black leader had received upon the senator's death in 1874. He borrowed the name for his writer's retreat from Charles Dickens' Bleak House. In the novel, Mr. Jarndyce established such a little library of books and papers as the refuge in which he hid when out of humor, the place I come and growl. When besieged by his large extended family of adult children, growing numbers of grandchildren, siblings real and fictive, his increasingly sickly wife, and assorted others, Douglas escaped to his growlery. Major parts of the first edition of Life and Times, published in 1881, were likely written there. His effort to order and control time in his final memoir masks the hidden pressures and dilemmas of his personal life. In that realm, about which he wrote so little, Douglas experienced plenty of pain and frustration about which to growl. As 1880 arrived, Douglas's personal life at Cedar Hill remained a roiling hub of family joy, domestic comfort, and turmoil. The continuing financial and career struggles of his sons and his daughter, as they began to reach early middle age with growing families, is the subtext for Douglas's steadfast views on black self-reliance, migration, property, the work ethic, and other values. All around him, at every turn, he saw necessity, striving, failure, dependence, contradiction, and more than 20 grandchildren, whom he hoped would live into the next century in a modern, more enlightened America. The personal and the public were thoroughly intertwined in every day of the aging Douglas's life. In speeches such as the one he gave at a black agricultural exposition in Raleigh, North Carolina, in October 1880, one hears echoes of his family's travails. The greatest want of blacks is regular and lucrative employments. They should acquire property and save money. The want of money, Douglas repeatedly declared to black workers and farmers, is the root of very many evils. It may seem harsh to us today, but in this period of racial subjugation, he maintained that blacks were despised more for their poverty than for their color. New life constantly flowed in and out of the universe of Cedar Hill and the Douglas clan, as Anna Murray Douglas became sometimes debilitated by illness. Douglas reported to Amy Post in April 1879 that his financial situation had nearly touched bottom. He had three families to support, including three of Rosa's children, part of Charlie's, whose wife is dead, and my old sick brother Perry and his daughter. Death began to visit with regularity, sometimes in natural course, and sometimes with shocking alarm. Charles, who was once again unemployed, with his two children, Freddie and Joseph, 11 and 9 years old, moved in with his brother, Frederick Jr., in November. The situation must have been tense and difficult. Frederick Jr. reported in handwritten notes in the scrapbooks he assembled that the two children were taken away by their father on January 3, 1881, after Charles secured a job with the U.S. Census Bureau. Moreover, on August 18, 1880, Douglas's half-brother, Perry Downs, died at Cedar Hill at age 67 and was buried the following day in the Hillsdale Cemetery. Many more funerals would soon be performed and planned from Cedar Hill. Into the early 1880s, Otterly Ossing remained occasionally in Douglas's life and often in his correspondence. With keen desire, she awaited her less regular orders, as she put it, to come to Washington for extended visits. Some stays in Washington, she told her correspondents, were truncated or burdened by the constant flow of cousins, grandchildren, and other parasites pursuing her beloved Douglas. She unabashedly complained that son Charles was still on the dole in 1878, and that the family whirlwind around Cedar Hill was uncivilized. She never seems to have commented on the sheer challenge of all the grandchildren for Anna, only for Ossing's admired male host. By the end of 1880, she reported a new tally of Eastern Shore kin who had arrived at Cedar Hill, including another half-sister named Kitty, and her son and his wife, who were living in a cottage by the garden. And an 8-year-old boy had just arrived, grandchild of another half-sister. Otterly thought him a bright boy, who could read and write, and might, therefore, bring Douglas some joy. Ossing loved the expansive mansion house and the grounds of nearly 15 acres. The house had been built in 1855-59 for an architect, John Welsh Van Hook. Douglas purchased the property with 9 acres. Over the next 16 years, he acquired 6 more adjoining acres and expanded the structure from 14 to 21 rooms, adding a large new kitchen wing and remodeling the attic into new bedrooms. On her first visit in October 1878, Ossing called it one of the most beautiful places in America, high on top of a hill with magnificent old trees. The view included the Capitol itself across the bridge over the Anacostia River. The grounds and stables included horses and cows, and Otterly especially enjoyed sitting on the grass and playing with a calf. But she never wrote to her friend Sylvester Kohler about her time at Cedar Hill without swipes at the domestic situation. The grandchildren included at one point a completely uncivilized girl of 6 years, so backward that even Mrs. Douglas could not provide educational influence. A 1-year-old boy, she observed, was a miserable, weakly child about whom she thought it a veritable crime to have brought him into the world. Once again, Anna, as well as Rosetta, who was frequently in and out of the house with her own 6 children, somehow coexisted with Ossing, if not with her attitudes. In an 1878 letter to Douglas, Otterly left a revealing self-description. "I am so entirely unlike the majority of men that I cannot well consider myself at all a standard by which to measure the feelings and sensations of others. A queer and unfortunate mixture of earthly and unearthly matter." Did Douglas sigh with pain or laughter or both? He was losing patience. By the late 1870s, Ossing sometimes grumbled about not receiving my weekly allowance, a letter from Douglas. He rarely visited her and her friends in Hoboken anymore, since that group had begun to disperse, and she found her life there increasingly lonely and, as she wrote in late 1878, quieter and more boring every year. Ossing frequently referred to her Hoboken circle of friends with the German word Bande, which denotes close, emotional, almost kinship-like ties. Her Bande had been dissolving, and she was adrift. The relationship with Douglas was in its last stage, as Ottilie quarreled mightily with her sister over their estate, fell into depressions, and once again, indecisively, planned a trip to Europe. In late summer 1878, Douglas expressed apprehensions about her potential visit, and apparently about their friendship itself, although we do not know precisely what he said. Some kind of experiment had been proposed, possibly about her staying away. "My feelings for you can never change," she wrote painfully. "But if all this, after all, is nothing to you, or if you anticipate for yourself more pain than pleasure, you know that you can shake me off whenever you please. Border state, Anna, is my smallest trouble. I think I have shown my diplomatic tact by getting along with her nearly 20 years without any serious trouble." Douglas and Ossing were undergoing a slow, if affectionate, breakup. There would be further visits to Washington until Ossing sailed for Germany for the final time in August 1881. From a subordinate position, Ossing continued to judge and try to micromanage her friend's ideas, actions, and financial decisions. She forever insisted on her absolutist approach to the monster of religion, and on one remarkable evening in late 1880, the two of them paid a visit to the home of a famous agnostic, Robert Ingersoll. The two had enriched, if complicated, each other's life in countless ways, and Douglas did not give up easily on this long-term relationship rooted in intellectual power. She still bought him cigars, and he rejoiced that he could yet write without spectacles. Her letter to him, with the profoundly sad offer that he could shake her when he pleased, ended with Ottilie's sudden, mundane, spouse-like question, "Are you sufficiently insured?" From as early as late 1878, Ossing became aware that Douglas's huge family was not her only competition, as the much younger 40-year-old Helen Pitts entered Douglas's circle of friends. Born in Honeoy, New York, of parents with strong abolitionist and feminist backgrounds, well-educated at Mount Holyoke College, and a former teacher in freedmen schools during the Civil War, Pitts first visited her uncle Hiram Pitts in Washington in the summer of 1878. Smart, outgoing, a lover of music, and adroit with her strong views on women's rights, Helen met the marshal and later got a job in his office. She also became involved with the journal Alpha, a publication of the Moral Education Society. Ossing detested, as she was also threatened by, Helen Pitts. After meeting her and participating in conversations, Ottilie wrote to Douglas with a venomous pen. Discussing press coverage about the orator's reputation, she remarked, "I anticipated nothing better on the part of the Pitts set and those connected with them. Mrs. Pitts," Helen was not married, "is a crafty, plotting woman." Ottilie seemed convinced that Helen was trying to extract money for some scheme from Douglas and offered strong, unsolicited advice. "The falling off in Mrs. Pitts's visits I should, however, consider a gain at any rate. There is a distressing lack of genuineness about her, which I imagine even to notice in her face." Ossing's scorn, utterly transparent, she spared Douglas none of her bitter emotions. She hated Alpha, calling it infamous, and claiming that no good and pure-minded woman can advocate those monstrous doctrines of obscene stuff hidden under religious cant. The magazine promoted combinations of religious faith, feminism, and women's education and equal rights. Only someone, Ossing held, who was incurably and irredeemably stupid could support such a journal. Such early denunciations of Helen came as Anna, ignored by the absolutist Ottilie, was still very much alive. There was only one future Mrs. Douglas, and Ottilie Ossing struggled hopelessly against the knowledge that it was not her. Chapter 27. Joys and Sorrows at Cedar Hill. "My joys have far exceeded my sorrows, and my friends have brought me far more than my enemies have taken from me." Frederick Douglass, 1881. The Douglases were blessed with some 21 grandchildren, and at any given time, many of them were either living at or visiting Cedar Hill. According to one of them, Frederica Sprague Perry, the fifth of Rosetta's seven children, who wrote an extraordinary memoir about her grandfather in 1941, Frederick Douglass was the best playfellow a child could ever want. When at home, the patriarch daily observed two distinct periods, his work time and his playtime. When at work behind his closed study door, remembered Frederica, who was born in 1872, the children knew that their grandfather would be greatly displeased by our noise. They would tiptoe down the hall in anticipation. When the door swung back on its hinges, we knew we were in for fun. Douglas stood with his legs braced apart, his large, stout frame ready for the onslaught. Taking the smallest child up on his shoulder, and with several others hanging on to his arms, legs, and coattail, he would, singing and shouting, march down the hall toward the kitchen, where Grandma Anna stood amused and distressed, supervising preparation for the evening meal. In this idealized domestic remembrance, perfected by time, the grandpa in his 60s would often go to all fours and play horse. As the children clambered on his broad back, Frederica recalled that the prize seat was nearest the head, nearly on his neck so that his long hair might serve as reins, and away we would gallop. The girls especially loved to run their hands in Douglas's ample head of hair, thick but not kinky, and he loved having the oldest among them comb and braid it. In quiet evening moments, the grand old man with closed eyes would sit an hour at a time as two girls brushed and tied the silvery locks into tight braids, independently stiff, and touched off on the ends with various colored ribbons. Douglas loved having his hair so treated, as it left him in a peaceful countenance. No one but the family ever saw this image, which occasioned much-needed laughter and shared bliss for Frederick and Anna. One time, Frederica reported, this reverie was interrupted by the doorbell and an important formal visitor. Douglas rushed to his bedroom, Anna and Rosetta in tow, to restore the head to its normal style of hairdress, to greet the guest, as giggly girls scampered to other corners of the house. Douglas's favorite outdoor game was croquet. The backyard of the A Street house, and especially the more spacious grounds at Cedar Hill, saw many such family competitions for young and old. Otilie Ossing wrote of playing croquet with a group of Douglases on the hilltop space between the house and the growlery in summer weather. Once it was playtime, the children enjoyed carefree, unrestrained freedom around their grandfather, Frederica reported. The extended family caused his financial burdens and numerous adult conflicts, but Douglas loved to entertain the children and let himself go. In the ceiling of the front porch of Cedar Hill, Douglas attached two rubber-covered spring rods, about 20 inches long. Each had a ring, and the adventurous could elevate and hang or do chin-ups from the handles. With his large body swinging in air, Douglas would dangle from these rings, the young children dancing and squealing at his feet as he kicked and shoved them about. This is hardly the textbook image of the noble, serious Douglas we have from his photographs, but the large, burly man pulling himself up and down with flying feet is how Frederica and her mates could remember him. They adored their big playmate, their mischievous tease, and their idolized teacher, who Frederica claimed instructed them about the beauty of generosity. What child would not thrill to have her grandfather transform into a human tree, stand perfectly erect, feet in bracing position, shoulders squared, and arms extended straight out, even with the shoulders? Bidding each child to clasp one of his arms and swing her body from the ground, the grandpa, full of life and energy, wrested a coveted joy from this endless swarm of love and adoration. It must have left all concerned with memories of Anna smiling and laughing, although no one ever wrote about her quite that way. Joy and sorrow lived together at Cedar Hill. In the presidential election of 1880, Douglas campaigned for candidate James A. Garfield, wherever Republicans allowed him to go. In this first post-Reconstruction presidential contest, Douglas's voice and symbolic service were less important to his party than in the Grant and Hayes administrations. For a while, the old abolitionist's star faded, eclipsed to a degree by the sheer sordidness and fury of Gilded Age politics, in which he was a practicing insider, and by a new generation of black leaders eager to shove the grand old man from his pedestal. In February of that year, Douglas's reputation suffered as he endured 2 days of testifying in the Capitol before Congress's Select Committee to investigate the Freedmen Savings and Trust Company. In the hearings, he told the story of the demise of the bank on his watch 6 years earlier, and of his $10,000 investment, which he did recoup. He admitted under oath that he knew nothing about banking. My life had been a theoretical one rather than a practical one, on the stump, and I hesitated about it until I was persuaded that as the colored people of the country generally had confidence in me. In this public testimony, Douglas half-heartedly took responsibility, but laid greater blame for the bank's failure on other managers, who made sure that he, as president, had been kept ignorant of the institution's real condition until it was too late. It was not Douglas's finest hour. He was treated fairly, since his good friend Senator Blanche Bruce chaired the committee. Garfield, the former Civil War general, 9-term congressman from Ohio, and Hayes loyalist with whom Douglas enjoyed only a distant and formal relationship, was the unlikely dark horse standard-bearer of the Republicans in the raucous election of 1880. Deep fissures ran through American party politics that year. The Democrats controlled a relatively solid South and staked their future nationally on white supremacy. Republicans were divided into two broad ideological camps, both of which devoted decreasing attention to black rights. The stalwart faction, led by Senator Roscoe Conkling, the extraordinarily corrupt and arrogant boss politician of New York City, originally took its name from staunch opposition to Hayes's let-alone policy toward the South during Reconstruction. By 1880, however, this class of elected officeholders managed a vast patronage system, especially fee-based federal and state bureaucracies that opposed civil service reform and fought to sustain the spoils system of appointments for the party faithful. Stalwarts still gave lip service to support of freedmen's rights, but offered little in the way of action. The second bloc among Republicans, known as the half-breeds, emerged around James G. Blaine, the senator from Maine. Blaine, a tall, natural politician, champion debater, and personal rival of Garfield's since the two entered Congress in 1863, had led occasional opposition to Grant from within the Republican Party, especially in response to the scandals of the general's second term. Half-breed was at first an epithet against this group, but as Grant-era corruption tainted the party at the end of Reconstruction, the term became a positive moniker. Half-breeds tended to be more open to civil service reform and, generally, more fiscally conservative. Some vestiges of the Civil War-era Republican Party of Lincoln still limped along, alive but crippled. The center of gravity in American politics had shifted decidedly to the Midwest, although it did not contain the nation's primary centers of patronage and wealth. The Republican Party had now largely become a vessel of big business, of corporate enterprise, of sound money backed by specie and anti-labor, especially since the violent nationwide Great Railroad Strike of 1877, when Hayes had used the U.S. Army to crush Union militants. Many conservative moral and social reform organizations of the era also drew thousands of adherents. The Christian lobby and groups such as the Women's Christian Temperance Union worked for laws against polygamy, obscenity, and alcohol. Intellectual liberal reformers, led by William Dean Howells, worried endlessly about what they deemed dangerous tendencies in American life, such as hostility to property, the excesses of universal suffrage, the masses of immigrants gaining access to the printing press and the ballot. Older Protestant, educated elites feared Eastern European immigrants, labor unions and anti-monopolism, lawless mobs, and socialism. Some third parties emerged as well, particularly the Greenback Party, made up of workers, farmers, and some socialists who advocated the paper money printed so successfully during the Civil War. The Greenback insurgency was a threat to Republicans in some localities, but in 1880 it garnered just over 300,000 votes. The abolitionists' heyday of Holy Crusade